I am very interested in writing about the condition of sadness and a kind of existential sadness, a sadness that I think is often linked to and intensified by the conditions of capitalism and alienation. What doesn't get discussed and what we don't talk about with each other and what social norms preclude us from incorporating into our everyday conversations and exchanges.
Hey, this is Bianca Stone, and you're listening to the RSH Podcast. I'm talking today with the poet Natalie Shapiro, who's the author of three books of poetry, Hard Child from Copper Canyon Press in 2017, No Object from Saturnalia in 2013, and just this year, Popular Longing from Copper Canyon Press. Her poems have appeared widely, including in The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine in poetry. She's received many awards and fellowships, including an NEA and Ruth Lilly. And I'm really happy to have Natalie on the podcast today. Please enjoy. So I thought I'd been liking starting the podcast with a poem to set the stage. And I would love it so much if you read the poem Green from your most recent book.
Green. I saw an image of Cleopatra being delivered to Caesar in a rolled up rug, just fallen from the rug. And at work, I began to be worried that others, and especially those in supervisory roles, viewed me as green, temperamentally inexpert. I tried wearing crisper shirts, but it didn't help. So of course, when all my friends began to die, I found at last a means of proving myself through inattention to their passing. I refrained from sharing remembrances. That time we pulled Bee's ruined tooth, or when Elle and I hiked out to the obverse side of the Hollywood sign. When colleagues sought to console me, I offered only the stoic rejoinder, death is a part of life. I underwent my yearly performance assessment and was prompted to name a task at which I excelled. I responded, truly knowing that death is a part of life. And when they requested I then articulate a plan for the coming year, I said, speaking louder when stating that death is a part of life, and perhaps appending an amplifying gesture. I returned to my desk and removed my heels and capped my pen and called Bee's mom and told her about the tooth. She recounted for me his younger years, mud-covered or up to his shoulders in the cold ocean. She said he had been ready to die, that through his suffering he'd sworn it several times. Though also he'd said several times that he wasn't ready. It was tough to know.
That's so good. I love that poem so much. I was noticing on the back of your book that it's often mentioned that you have a sense of humor and that you use a lot of wry tones in your poems. How do you feel about this commentary on your humor, and how do you think humor works in your poems?
I appreciate that read on it, and I do often try to put jokes in poems, often to simulate the way that in casual conversation people engage in joke making when something turns unpleasant or uncomfortable. Yeah. And, thinking about what are those jokes sort of code for, what's underneath them, what are they covering up? So every time there's a joke in one of my poems, it's to cover up something that's in the poem underneath it. And so my hope is that the jokes make the poems sadder than they otherwise would be.
I mean, that's exactly what happens, I feel like. That's why it's so interesting to sort of read the book and then look at the commentary on the book and be like, oh, she's so funny. And it's like, I felt, there's so much like intensity and so much complex sadness in the book as well. They seem to go hand in hand. The other thing I was thinking is, maybe this is connected, but like your poems, I mean, you're very direct, very narrative in your work. And yet you have this incredible gift for negative capability and for leaving things out of the poem. Like in the middle of a thought or a line, there'll be a distinctly missing word or part or a piece of information. And even in this, especially in this new book, a lot of the times the poems will end with a dash. And I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about, and you can, you know, maybe in Popular Longing specifically, but a little bit about if you feel drawn to writing about what is unthinkable or unwritable or uncomfortable. Anything around there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I am super interested in what doesn't get discussed, and what we don't talk about with each other, and what kind of social norms preclude us from incorporating into our everyday conversations and exchanges.
Yeah.
And I think that the poems try to, you know, I'm interested in writing poems that try to perform that enforced silence and stay silent when they're supposed to be silent and kind of obey the rules and as a way of chafing against it, I guess. It's a little bit passive aggressive.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like that with the humor too, because actually what I was thinking, especially it came through really strongly this poem, but like you know, yes, you're a stand-up comic, but you're kind of just mirroring what exactly is going on and showing how hilarious it is in a dark way, because people aren't trying to be funny but it's a funny situation because we're sort of saying what we don't mean to say or covering things up, exactly like you said.
Yeah, that's a huge interest of mine, is what do people say when you feel compelled to talk about something, but the subject matter or your angle on it is prohibited? What do you put there instead?
Yeah. That's so awesome. Tell me about the creation of your latest book and how the whole thing came to be.
Yeah, I mean, it has a few different through lines. The first poem is set kind of in a museum at the site of a big art world transaction.
Yeah.
And a lot of the poems in the book are interested in different kinds of transactional relationships, and specifically like the ways in which funding structures that might be occluded actually dictate what we experience of the world and what we remember and how we kind of interpret our own lives. And I think about that a lot when I'm in a museum. What I'm interested in is the way that there are different kind of financial incentives and and kind of systems of exchange and profiteering that produce what you know I see before me
when
I just wander into a museum and look at the wall, and when I'm having some kind of intense emotional reaction to a powerful piece of art, trying to keep in mind that reaction can be kind of directly traced back to various aspects of the market economy that
Jesus, that is I almost feel bad for you. That's what you're thinking of when you're in a museum. I want to trace this feeling I'm having in front of this painting back to the market economy. Fuck them.
100%.
I mean, in the end, there's a long poem in sections that meditates a lot on different angles of like experiencing art in a museum, but that seems there. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, all of the stuff in that poem kind of about the way that museums kind of incite dissent and then capture and monetize it.
Yeah.
Is a fascination of mine. Just like the role of institutions and structuring not just our, you know, material circumstances, but our just our psychic lives.
Yeah, and that poem you read, I mean, it's... Here it is. We don't know where the speaker is working, but it has this very, like, work environment feeling, like, office environment. And there does feel like... It's like a yearning to be, to fit into it and to be part of it, but it's with like, it's almost like a dismantling of it by saying death is a part of life. She's trying to fit in by saying this or trying to do the right thing by saying this, but actually continuously saying it in inappropriate times is sort of like undoing the sentiment, which is like one of those moments of saying something to cover up something else. So I love how you're very subtle in how you deal with these interests and themes in your poems.
Yeah, I mean, this poem is, pretty squarely interested in labor politics and, mm-hmm. You know, just the phenomenon of like bereavement is kind of inconvenient for and glossed over by employer employee relations, like by which I mean, you know, exploitation.
Yeah.
And this idea of a speaker who has kind of, you know, internalized that and is like, how do I prove myself at work? Oh, I finally got a chance when people I loved started dying and I could show my job that I was still just coming into work and working and caring about it. And then, you know, it turns into this, this sort of, obsession with performing, just like steeliness and dedication to the work environment over everything else.
And but actually, say it.
No, I mean, that's what many workers are in fact compelled to do, obviously.
Yeah. I know it felt creepy, but totally believable in this weird way. You know, it was hyperbolic, but it was still like, yeah, exactly. Interestingly, though, I feel all of that's here, but yet the poem ends so intimately, I think, with what is a recurring theme in the book, which is experiencing bereavement and loss and trying to look at that. Death seems I wouldn't say quiet, but it's, I'll use the word subtle again, theme that is explored in your poems throughout your books. Not having experienced death, but even just thinking about death, and the differences between being alive and being dead and wanting to be dead, but also not. And it's not cut and dry. It's not black and white about how the speaker has this relationship with their own death and the death of other people. And I think that gray area in between wanting and not wanting, understanding and not understanding, is where you explore really well. And in this book particularly, tell me a little bit about how you see poetry being a vehicle to explore such massive human issues as one's own death.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I appreciate always, kind of about the conventions of poetry and how we write it, is that it can be a small container, but a sturdy container that can hold these really heavy things. And I think that I am very interested in writing about the condition of sadness and a kind of existential sadness, a sadness that I think is often link to and fostered by and intensified by the conditions of capitalism and alienation. And I am interested in sort of writing toward like a feeling of nothing, which feels like the feeling of death.
Yeah.
And it's something that is very hard to capture. And so I think, like many people, I've written many poems about it in an attempt to try to get there.
When you say writing towards a feeling of nothing, do you mean you want the poem to experience that going towards nothing, or the reader to experience that, or you yourself as a writer are trying, as a person rather, or both, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. I want to invite people to, I guess, think about what that feels like and why why the poems are drawn toward it. I'm not myself trying to kind of write into a feeling of oblivion that I have in my own life. I think in my own life I try to bracket those poems as much as possible.
Yeah. It does seem in a lot of the poems that the speaker is desperate to escape into a kind of oblivion. And I think maybe that's where the death exploration comes in as well, is that death is what we're told is oblivion in a way. So figuring out, is that true? Is that the only way to experience nothing?
I think, I think that's right. You know, I think there are a few different kind of impulses that I'm trying to deal with in the book. And one is just, like we talked about the other poem as being hyperbolic, and maybe these poems are somewhat like in almost like if you can't beat them, join them thing. Like if you feel this this intense sadness and it isn't abating and there isn't a different world to go into, that's not our world, then write toward that oblivion, as you say, write toward that nothingness. I just want to say, like, you know, it's an art project. Like, I think in real life we need to come together and love each other to build the world that should be. Yeah. I'm not an advocate of giving up.
Right, of course.
In our daily lives, but I do. I think the book is a way of marking the feeling of, just give up. That is so endemic.
Yeah.
And a way of trying to call it out by writing it.
Yeah.
Our
culture is one that doesn't allow for that type of exploration in a way. It's very filled with noise and things and distractions, and we don't even have a chance to plumb the depths of our impulse towards oblivion, which seems so prevalent and all-consuming but hidden beneath all the distractions. And so, of course, you know, the poem is like the perfect place, right? It's it's a slowing down and examining something on the page in words, therefore an ability to image it in your head. And that's all that's occurring. I mean, that's certainly what happens when I read your poems. I get to really slow down and move towards that. And it feels actually the combination of like a sardonic humor and a sadness is, I mean, I know I said this to you in an email before, but I completely relate to that impulse in poetry. Like for me, like that's where something more true is happening, in terms of consciousness. And, you know, now thinking about what you're saying about this, you know, these institutions and this capitalistic system that we find ourselves standing amid trying to do these things is, all you can do is sort of mirror it on the page and, expose it for what it is. And then also know that, well, we're all in it together. You know, we're all these people here, you know, we're the ones peopling these places, these museums and these workplaces and these schools and whatnot. People in your poems are interesting. They seem alluded to yet absent often.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Is that purposeful or?
Yeah.
By mistake.
I am, especially with this book, I think I really wanted to capture atmospheres and feelings and stories, but I didn't want settings particularly.
Interesting.
And I feel that way with the people. Like I'm interested in describing the emotional dynamics that happen between people who are in proximity to each other. But I often find that there are so many associations attached to different the names we give to different relationships that we have to each other, that they kind of make the poem busy in a way I don't want. I also, you know, I'm interested in kind of writing about community in a more, I'm interested in writing about like community, right? Being in a community. And so,
right. I felt that was like the neighbors and
there's sort of like a stock character in my work.
who's a neighbor?
Yeah. And those, the interactions, that animated poems that have my neighbor in it, it's not my literal neighbor. But it is, that's a useful kind of way of thinking about relationships to me as like, you know, kind of like we're all neighbors, right? We're all
right
beside each other, for better and for worse with all of that brings. And I also think this book is a lot about my neighborhood that I used to live in, that I lived in when I was writing it. And I really was interested in that particular neighborhood as kind of, you know, exemplary of a lot of the dynamics that the book is interested in. It was,
this was in California.
It was in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just a neighborhood that has, that was, you know, going through like a intense, population displacement. And
so having these kind of conversations in the poems almost stabilized it or not stabilized it, but, held on to some part of it, or you were able to communicate with that place, as it was changing so rapidly.
Some of the interactions are not, they're not particularly like rosy or not things that I feel nostalgic for.
The stock character of the neighbor that wasn't actually your neighbor in real life. just a moment like to pause over, because I see so many, you know, working with students and stuff on their poems, like, who feel ultra beholden to reality and not ever doing, like, they would never think that that's okay to do in a poem, to be like, well, this poem is going to fit the reality that I'm creating out of whatever this agreed upon reality is. And making this neighbor character out of maybe multiple people, is right. What poetry is all about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that, different writers are going to have different priors on this. And I certainly know a lot of writers who write from their lives, and, it's important that their books are records of their lives. And I think it's, I like a lot of those projects very much. But I am super private. And I think that for me, that's, it's partially just dispositional. It's partially because, it's partially because I think it gives me more freedom as a private person in life. I want to sometimes put things in books that I don't want, to be, that I don't discuss.
Yeah.
In my life. And so, and I also want the kind of creative freedom that you're talking about to sort of shift things around and, take, something that happened at one time and situate it in another, or, you know, like that I can tell you, you refer to the driving by the old apartment, building, that's, that scene as it is described in that poem, did not happen. I mean, I have previously passed places where I used to live. It's not that's never happened to
right
me.
I mean, it's like it didn't happen, but it's such a thing that happens.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Some, you know, whatever, it's part of the writing process. Sometimes if you kind of restructure the elements of the story, you can get the feeling across better than if you tell the actual story and it's
right,
it's sort of long and clunky or whatever.
Right.
But I also think it, you know, if you like, my thing is always like, I know I just said that driving past the old building thing didn't happen, but a lot of things in the book, you know, I just want them to be understood as composites to some extent, so that, I can talk about real things in the book and have some, not have people be like, oh, I read your book, I learned this about you. I always want to be able to say no, because exactly what, you know, we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, there are things that there are kind of that are hard to talk about, or that aren't heard well
right,
you do talk about them. And so it's almost a defense. It's a defense mechanism in some way that has become like an aesthetic commitment.
A defense mechanism that's become an aesthetic commitment. Brilliant. And I, you know, what is this crazy poet impulse to want to write about things you can't even talk about to people in your life, even to yourself in a way? So much of the unconscious comes up in the poetry. I feel drawn to writing about it, have to write about it, but, and yet always one is able to, if, you know, one must keep a certain amount of distance and ambiguity and negative capability in there in order to do it at all, in order to do it justice. And I think it needs that ambiguity for the reader to step in.
Yeah.
Let's hear one.
Okay.
I can suggest, or is there one that maybe speaks to? What about Say It to My Face?
Say It to My Face. In this age of nostalgia, all I really have is how speeding by the salt-bitten building where I used to live, I don't point it out. What a lowly source of pride, the refusal to inflict on one's carpool companions a past address. Look at me, not making it about me. But what would anyone have to say except, oh, they never were there. They don't know the insolent kitchen. They can't still smell the skewers in the foil tin or the stink of shots at a late hour when guests had mostly gone. That must have been Jay's 40th. Or maybe the vigil for tea? This is why we shouldn't have occasions. Same crowd, same food, same room. It runs together. A scene in my mind seems buoyant, and then I realize. But even worse is the other way around. Why is it that any time I half ascend this heap of pain, I get cut down?
It's so good. I love the construction of it. Your construction of the poems are really incredible, and I love too how the construction of the book works, and how the poems really speak to one another, and the order is very deliberate. Is ordering and constructing a manuscript, does that come natural to you, or is that something that's changed since your last book?
Yeah, I think my interest in it has kind of intensified over time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, my machines are trying to talk.
Well, you got to hear my cat howl for like 15 minutes, so.
That's way better. I think that I tend to write pretty spare poems, pretty small poems, and I don't like to do a lot of expositional work. So part of what I did in writing this book was try to like have some of the later poems rely on the earlier poems. Just kind of orienting the reader to what they're talking about. Okay. So that it's not like you have to start from scratch with every single poem.
Okay. Yeah.
But I also, I use it sometimes, to equivocate. That's like, it's one of the nice things about being a poet, rather than many other kinds of writers, is you can, approach the same exact subject from a different perspective and come to a different conclusion and make a different argument.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, I want the poem. Sometimes I just use it sort of for callbacks, for joke structure and that kind of thing, where you just plant it, you plant something early on, and then later a poem is pointing back to something that you already are familiar with and doing a new sort of spin on it or whatever.
Yeah, that the one that was like, no one ever saw her first.
Yeah.
That was so masterfully done. Because that line was like kind of tripping me up. I was like, oh, is that a saying? And then like I had to think about it for a minute. And I was like, oh, I totally get it. And then I kept going. And then it like came back. And I was like, just like you said. I mean, yeah, very fun. I mean, I just love the fun you're having with the construction of the poems.
No, I like, you know, I like a running, I like a running joke. I like it in life. I like it in a book.
Yeah. Did I read you? You were got a degree, a law degree or a pre-law degree or?
Yeah, no, I was a lawyer.
Okay.
I was a civil rights litigator with a nonprofit in DC, and it was sort of a fascinating and an amazing experience in a lot of ways. I ended up kind of coming back to the poetry world, and feeling like, sort of temperamentally that was the right, place for me. And,
lucky for us.
Thanks for having me.
Goddamn right, you're back.
but it was pretty kind of amazing to be able to have this intellectual experience and work experience in something else. And I don't practice law anymore. I just recently formally retired.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. You have a retirement party?
It was just checking a box on the bar website. So no party necessary. I think that as a sort of very deliberative person and a slow thinker, I felt fortunate to have a home in literature where that sort of deliberation and slowness can be kind of baked into how things work.
I love that. So we're winding down to the end here. I think you've already said why it's important to you to write poetry, although I would like to hear any more thoughts on that. But also, like, I think, actually, why is it important to read poetry, and for you, and you think for other people, is really more to the point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna tell you, like, super honestly, that I think. I have had the most stirring and resonant and revelatory experiences reading poems and living in the cerebral and emotional states that they manufacture, which I think poems can be sort of uniquely suited to do because of their concision and their potential for ambiguity through that concision and holding so many different meanings and states at the same time. And I think it has been, you know, I have had many incredible times living inside of poems that I've read that have been meaningful to me. So I definitely recommend it.
Yeah.
But I also think that there are a lot of other, you know, it's a big world and there are a lot of other things that offer that kind of transport and epiphany. So I respect reading poetry, and I also respect deriving that stuff from elsewhere.
Yeah. You know, I feel that way reading this. I just love this. I love your poems so much. And I feel that reading them, I feel like, oh, thank you. Like, very grateful to have someone get me into that state of experiencing something ineffable, but what feels very real and very honest. And, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your engagement with the book. It means so much.
Do you want to end with maybe one of the poems from Iterant?
Yeah, sure.
Is it kind of short? We could read two. So we're thrilled to have Natalie's poems on the latest issue of Iterant.
Can I read the first one?
Can you read both of them?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Is that too much? Is that too indulgent?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Whenever you're ready.
Have you been wanting to go to sleep and not wake up? I answered no, having long contended that sleep offers only the drawbacks of death, inability to partake in nature and drugs, without the big benefit, no longer being alive. Sleeping forever? No thanks. I have, though, been wanting to take up acting in order to get myself a death scene. The key is the constructed landscape, going out in front of a plywood backdrop, barber shop, or bed of rocks. It doesn't matter. What matters is securing a different world to die in, as I refuse to die in this one. I won't give it the satisfaction, not that it is ever satisfied. And the next one is called Suffertescent Scrub.
I love that word, suffertescent.
As a child, I was taken with a story I'd read in some volume about a traveler who died in Death Valley, not of heat, but of cold. Determined to set the world record for longest exposure, he'd packed his body in ice enough to do him in. I think of him anytime your name is mentioned, or God forbid we encounter each other. I think of his terminal overcompensation, as I insist what a gift you are, the gentlest gem of this city. It's always so good to see you. It's so, so good.
Natalie,
sarcasm.
Natalie and her sarcasm. I love it. I love it so much. We need it. From the right people. Natalie Shapiro, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast and talking with us. It's really been wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, as always, for listening to the podcast. You can read Natalie's poems at iterant.org, and you can buy her books by clicking on the link in the show notes of the podcast page. Thank you, Walter Stone, for providing the piano music. See you next time.
Say it in the microphone.
Nothing to hear.